morning. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is back in session. We have three arguments today. This is the second of our three arguments. I see counsel are present. I'll ask the marshal to call the case so our oral record is clear. Go right ahead, Marshal.
I'm calling file number A19-1905, Jill Nicole Prokup versus Christopher John Prokup.
Right, and I see counsel are here and appearing via WebEx, as is the court. I just want to make sure everyone knows what to do in case you do lose us, have a problem with your connection or with your sound, either visual or audio. I think you have some instructions on alternatives, right? Yeah, okay. And then I'll just give you a couple of quick reminders. Here's the first one is when you're not speaking. So in other words, when you're listening, if you would please turn on your mute button, that seems to improve the sound quality quite a bit. You'll see the judges do the same thing. And we'll just, of course, change that when we want to ask you a question. And secondly, as you begin your remarks, if you would identify yourself for the record, as well as a client that you recommend you are representing, that means that we will have a clear record for listening to this audio again later. And then the last thing is, you can see that the marshal does have a clock visible in his portion of the WebEx. So that clock will count down. And then of course, when you get to zero, we'd ask you to stop. Appellant, you've got 15 minutes in opening and then a 5-minute optional rebuttal. And of course the respondent has 15 minutes. So with that, I think we're ready to proceed. Counsel for appellant, you can begin when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I represent appellant Christopher Prokup, P-R-O-K-O-P, and my name is Matt Gilbert, G-I-L-B-E-R-T. October 15th of 2018, the parties appeared for a pretrial. It is a part of the pretrial, the parties put together a written stipulation outside of the courtroom. The stipulation provided in pertinent part that the issue of child support and spousal maintenance would be submitted in lieu of a trial, and that the parties would make written submissions on those two issues. Contrary to the stipulation, the parties then went before the Dakota County Court judge, and the parties had various discussions on the record regarding what would happen with regard to trial, as well as other issues. The record provides specifically that when Mr. Prokup was asked by his district court counsel, he was asked chiefly, do you understand the only thing we're going to leave in the judge's hands at some point would be spousal maintenance? Do you understand that? Appellant responded, yes. With regard to what subsequently happened is following what was read onto the record, the parties submitted the parties submitted a proposed order and submissions with regard to support. And then contrary to what the parties had agreed upon, the issue, other issues were also submitted at a later date. And with regard to Mr. Prokop's trial counsel did send a couple letters to the court identifying that he had never agreed to submit other issues to the court, and that he wanted those issues to be resolved pursuant to a trial in open court. Contrary to this, the district court ultimately entered a judgment and decree resolving all issues. In doing so, Mr. Prokup was denied an ability to call witnesses, to cross-examine witnesses, to respond to respondents' new claims, including a claim for attorney's fees, and including a claim for a dissipation claim regarding marital assets. In addition to that, the parties' written agreement, nor did any information on the record identify that appellant had agreed to that the custody and parenting time was in the best interest of the minor child. Minnesota law makes it clear.
I have a question for you about the discussion relating to the equalizer. And you state that in the transcript, there was a question of your client regarding the issues to be submitted to the judge in that, sorry, I'm just finding the transcript here. So the question was, chiefly, do you understand the only thing we're going to leave in the judge's hands at some point would be spousal maintenance? Do you understand that? Yes. And his response was yes. But there was also a discussion about getting paperwork to opposing counsel so that the equalizer could be agreed upon between the parties. And then there was some prior discussion between counsel and the judge that if the parties weren't able to agree on the equalizer, that they would submit the documentation to the judge so the judge could decide that. And I think the transcript's clear that appellant's prior counsel agreed to that process. And then in viewing the transcript as a whole, your client was also asked, do you know what happened this morning and what was going on? And he responded, yes. And do you have any questions about the settlements that were made today? And he responded, no. So in light of the entire transcript, how did the district court judge err in finding, or how was the district court judge finding that there was a meeting of the minds as to what would be submitted? How was that clearly erroneous? Because it seems to me in our review of that determination, we are to apply the clearly erroneous standard. That was a factual determination by the judge that there was a meeting of the minds on that question.
Thank you, Your Honor. The issue is whether the trial court, any waiver of a trial right needs to be clear and unequivocal. The burden of proof with regard to the waiver of a trial right rests on the person asserting that the waiver occurred.
But wouldn't you agree that in terms of whether there was a waiver, we're reviewing your request, your motion for a new trial, and the district court's denial of that motion, and in the district court's denial of that motion, there was a determination that there was a meeting of the minds, and so there isn't any denial of due process.
We can read the transcript. The transcript is as clear as mud when I read it, to be frank. There's case law basically saying where there's contradictory demands that there's no waiver that could have occurred. And this is Weber Electric versus Tuminelli Incorporated. Again, the waiver needs to be clear and unequivocal. And just based upon that portion of the transcript alone, saying the only issue that the judge will decide is spousal maintenance, do you understand that? That was the understanding of appellant. And this is about due process and him being afforded his right to due process, which includes the right to present argument, to call witnesses, and to respond.
So is it your view that there was no trial in this case?
There was not a trial. There's not a trial in open court as required under the rules. Mr. Prokop did not have notice of the arguments that respondent was making relative to attorney's fees, as well as a dissipation claim. He was not afforded a right to respond to these claims. And these are fundamental tenets of due process. There's a US Supreme Court case, Cleveland, a Board of Education, which describes that these are just fundamental.
Mr. Gilbert, can I ask you about that point you just made? Was it not true, however, though, and the transcript points to this, there was extensive discussion about a submission deadline and submitting information to the court, which I assume was copied to both council and so forth. And there seemed to be some desire to get it done before the end of the year. So there was a lot of discussion about dates where this information would be submitted. Are you indicating that your client wasn't allowed to submit information or didn't receive the information submitted by wife's counsel? I'm a little unsure what you meant by unable to respond.
Absolutely, Your Honor. The schedule that the court had implemented did not permit Mr. Prokop an opportunity to respond to some of these new claims, including a claim for attorney's fees, including a claim regarding a dissipation of marital assets. And there seems to be a lot of confusion in the record, and there's ample case law saying where there's confusion, that it's just inequitable to hold a party responsible if there's confusion on behalf of an attorney. Clearly, Mr. Prokop understood when we look at the transcript that the issue that would be decided by the judge was spousal maintenance. If you look at Hafley and Charson versus Temple Israel, the courts have, as an equitable remedy, have looked at an attorney's confusion or oversight and say it's not equitable or it's not affording a litigant due process to not have their day in court, to not be able to have a trial on these issues.
So is it your view that the district court's finding that there was an agreement to submit the issues to the judge, the equalizer issue to the judge, is it your view that that was a clearly erroneous finding?
That is correct, Your Honor. Again, if you look at the transcript, it's all over the place. And that part alone, you understand the only issue the judge will decide is spousal maintenance. That is what appellant understands. Appellant, he's a blue-collar worker. He gets information and advice from his attorney, and he's telling him the only issue the judge will decide is spousal maintenance. The judge never clarified that remark. There was no objection. That was his understanding of what was going to happen moving forward.
Counsel, I just wanted to follow up on a question I had earlier about whether there was a trial in this case, and I think you agreed that there wasn't a trial. If that's the case, is a motion for a new trial the proper procedure to raise your due process argument? In other words, in your motion to the district court, you filed a motion for a new trial and a motion to reopen the judgment and decree. And it seems to me if there wasn't a trial, the proper challenge would be to the district court's denial of the request to reopen the judgment and decree. But it doesn't appear to me that you're raising that, challenging that determination in this appeal.
Your Honor, I mean, it's really a matter of semantics, whether it's reopening the judgment and decree or whether it's a new trial. Either way, Mr. Prokop was not afforded due process here. To quickly address some of these other issues, there's a finding of fact 8 describes the parties stipulated that the custody and parenting time is in the best interest of the minor child. Appellant never made such a stipulation. That finding is clearly erroneous on its face. Additionally, the party's written agreement specifically provided that appellant would be awarded half of the sale proceeds of the marital homestead. Mr. Prokop or appellant was not awarded what was provided for in the agreement. And under Tuffhill, he should have been awarded the agreement, what was agreed upon, or otherwise he should have had his day in court on that issue. Lastly, with regard to Mr. Prokop's traditional IRA, it's clearly a retirement asset. There's a finding it's a retirement asset. It's in the conclusions of law as a retirement asset. Under 26 USC 408 D1, the federal taxation code clearly defines a traditional IRA as a before-tax asset, and it should be treated as such with regard to the division of the retirement assets. And if the court looks at Maurer as well as most recently in Curtis, the Supreme Court has described that the taxation creating the consequences required is likely to occur is when the court should look at the taxable nature of a retirement asset. And with regard to the equalizer payment, there's a separate equalizer payment in the judgment and decree, and there's no need to speculate what the Mr. Prokop's income might be or his taxable rate might be when he actually retires and takes distributions. Again, in Minnesota, it's become commonplace to have a separate retirement equalizer and to divide pre-tax assets and after-tax assets in kind, according to separate equalizers. So there's no speculation that courts have been concerned about before regarding what an applicable taxable rate may be. In addition to that, you know, our brief firmly lays out that with regard to the due process issues, if waiver occurred, it needs to be clear and unequivocal, and the burden is on the party asserting waiver occurred. And again, from the record, it's very unclear that there was any waiver.
So, Mr. Gilbert, your time is just about up. We're at 30 seconds remaining. I don't see any questions from the panel members. Is that right? Okay. Of course, Mr. Gilbert, you will also have 5 minutes for rebuttal, but if you'd like to use your last few seconds to say something, go right ahead. All right. Then with that, I think we are ready as soon as the marshal has reset the clock for respondents' argument. So counsel for respondent, as soon as you see the clock set, you can begin your remarks. Thank you.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Linda DeBeer and I represent the respondent, Jill Prokop. I'm gonna start with some of the quicker issues and just go through them very fast. With the issue of tax consequences, it's important to note that Mr. Prokop never asked the court to divide the retirement account that he now complains wasn't tax affected. He did make a property submission, though he claims that he didn't know property was going to be decided. Our addendum has his property submission that was made on November 8th. It's in our addendum at pages 2-5. And he did not ask the court to divide that asset. So to ask for it now on appeal or to claim that there was error because that didn't occur just simply can't be sustained. There is absolutely no information in the record about tax consequences. While appellant claims that he did not have the opportunity to respond, this is the type of information that would be part of a case in chief that he could have submitted with the rest of his property proposal. It is not something that would be submitted in rebuttal. So he certainly wasn't denied the opportunity to make that argument for it to be divided or to submit the tax consequence information. He simply chose not to do it. The court treated both parties equally. Neither of their Vanguard accounts are tax affected. And also the appellant and respondent both agree that the trial court has discretion to disregard tax consequences. It can be considered too speculative. And here where there's literally nothing in the record upon which a court could tax affect them, there simply isn't any clearly erroneous error. I won't spend as much time on the custody issue either because I think that's pretty clear. The parties stipulated to this custody arrangement. And in fact, appellant's own counsel supplemented the record as we were reading these agreements into the record along with our stipulation. And he explained that this child has no relationship with appellant, none at all. And the other thing—
So even where there's a stipulation, isn't there an obligation for the court to consider the best interest factors?
Your Honor, I do believe that that is appropriate. And I would also clarify for this court's record that We were appearing in front of the district court on a temporary motion, not a pretrial. In fact, once we entered into the alternative means of settling their property estate and spousal maintenance, we canceled the pretrial. So that appearance in October was for a temporary proceeding. Our trial court was ready to hear our proceeding. We had filed extensive affidavits, which included 6 pages of detailed findings about the best interests of this young girl. So we had a stipulation where both parents agreed that Ms. Prokop would have sole legal and sole physical custody. We had appellant's counsel reading into the record that there was absolutely no relationship between appellant and this child. We had a district court record that had affidavits and detailed findings about the best interest factors. I inquired of Ms. Prokop whether she believed the settlement was in this child's best interest. And then also, appellant is seeming to ignore that these issues were raised to the district court, and the district court in a subsequent order made very detailed findings about the best interests of this child in denying joint legal custody. And those findings reflect that there continues to be absolutely no relationship with this parent and child, and that the problems are very long-standing. So when we're reviewing this district court's actions under the clearly erroneous standard, the record is replete with evidence that supports the court's determination. Turning to the issue of waiver, similarly, appellant argues that he did not waive his trial rights. I think it's important to understand the sequence of events that day, that we appeared for a temporary hearing. We worked outside of the courtroom for hours trying to resolve permanent issues. We were able to reduce some of them to writing. Once that writing was completed, we entered the courtroom, offered it to the court, and then made subsequent agreements on the record. So when appellant says that the spousal maintenance stipulation doesn't mention property process, it hadn't happened yet. It literally hadn't happened. It then happened in the courtroom.
Mr. Beer, can I? Where in the record does respondent indicate that he understood that the issue of the property equalizer would be submitted to the judge if the parties weren't able to agree to reach an agreement by November 12th, by that November 12th date?
Yes, I could only cite to the transcript as a whole that there was quite a bit of conversation about this, where for several pages we talked about the dates and we talked about, you know, it was necessitated because he hadn't answered discovery. So this alternative method, which I actually do consider a trial on written submissions, was developed to give appellant the benefit of having a tax deduction because the law was changing so dramatically on January 1st, 2019. So we were all pushing to have a final decree which would benefit them both, but largely him. And we were pushing to complete this when he hadn't answered formal discovery, it was overdue. And even the final decree has references to mechanisms that we proposed to try and be fair and help him once the information came in. I mean, there's statements that if our documents received pursuant to subpoena show a different number, that it would be taken into account. And we also proposed a mechanism to protect him if there was a double counting between an investment account and a savings account. So we were all pushing to have a final decree. And for him to now say, I never intended to stipulate to this process, I wanted a trial on property, it doesn't make sense. The record reflects we canceled the pretrial. And the transcript reflects we were doing everything in our power to get it done before New Year's Eve in 2018. Further, I think it really is disingenuous when he argues that he didn't waive his trial rights, yet he participated in the process. He made a submission on the property submission date. So he claims he didn't waive his trial rights, yet he followed the process that we developed and we read into the record.
But in his submission, which is in your addendum, doesn't he, basically he makes the submission, but he also says the, in his letter to the judge, he notes, if you review the transcript, you will note on several occasions I addressed the court that the only issue it had to decide was spousal maintenance. So one way to interpret the letter is he is trying to preserve that issue for appeal, yet still make sure that he's doing his best to represent his client's interest and submit information about the property.
He did, he has said that repeatedly in correspondence, but again, if we look to the credibility of that statement, we were all pushy to try have a final decree by the end of the year. And basically, appellant's position is, well, we have this agreement. I got to keep all of the property in my name, and she kept all the property in her name. Where is that agreement then? Why isn't that read into the record? Why would we be exchanging more information? Why would we be discussing an equalizer again and again and again if his historic perspective was that other property issues were settled? Why would we cancel the pretrial? I think this is one of those determinations of credibility, really. And for him to say that he didn't know we were going to do this, it just completely lacks credibility. I would say that the closest case on point is the one of Clark. Some of the cases that Mr. Gilbert has cited about the burden of proof and waiver are in civil litigation cases, and they're not really about trial or process. They're about whether a party waived their right to a contract term, which I think is very not on point. I mean, we really need cases that are about trial rights. And I think the two cases that come closest are Clark and Haefeli. And in Haefeli, there was concern that there was confusion caused by the court really blending two hearings, blending a hearing of whether to reopen a decree with the valuation and division of assets. And because of that blending, it's reasonable that Mr. Haefeli and his counsel were confused about what is the burden of proof that they should be aware of and how should they present their evidence. Here, there's no confusion. I mean, it's divorce 101 that assets get divided. And we represented to the court it was a very simple asset case, and it is. There, I don't even understand how he could say that there's confusion about what was expected, especially when he then followed through and did make a submission.
Would you agree, Ms. DeBeer?
Go ahead, Judge Sleater.
But I was curious, Ms. DeBeer, would you agree at a minimum we're looking at the record in entirety in order to, and I think the phrase you used, the follow-through, might be more of an implication. Is one thing that's clearly missing is a clear statement by both counsel and then a follow-up to both clients that we do have an agreement that we will not have a trial other than through submission of documents. I didn't see that anywhere in the record. So your point being is we look at the entire record and what happened afterwards and maybe the cancellation of trial dates or pretrial dates, so forth. But there was no clear waiver, at least either identified by the attorneys and then followed up with a waiver by their clients. by your clients.
I do wish we had done a better job, for sure, about presenting that. But I think with the cancellation of the pretrial and stating that we wouldn't need it, and the repeated statements that we needed to get this done by the end of the year, I really believe they understood what was happening, and I think our district court judge did too. I mean, this issue was raised to him, and he made a factual finding. I believe it was in paragraph 6 of his March 27th order, where he went through the different claims, and he stated that there was no confusion, and I may have even summarized them here if I can find them. You know, the respondents' claims of mutual mistake are unfounded and unsupported by the record. Respondent fails to identify any error in the facts or law or demonstrate how he was prejudiced. In Haefeli, Mr. Haefeli was prejudiced, but here he was not. I mean, we've had two reviews for clerical mistakes. And, you know, the one review created a debt owed from wife to husband for $50. And while he asserts incompetence of counsel is a reason to reopen, it's simply not a ground. So I agree, there could have been a much better waiver than what we attempted to do. But I do think looking at the entire transcript and all the circumstances, and even appellant's own actions of making a property submission, show that he knew we were not going to have a trial and the reason why. I have nothing further unless there's any more questions.
Any questions from the panel members? All right. Thank you, Ms. DeBeer. We appreciate your remarks today. And Mr. Gilbert, with that, the marshal will reset the clock to 5 minutes, and you can proceed with your rebuttal when you are ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. As a threshold issue, expediency should not take away from appellant's due process rights. Those are paramount. And again, I understand the urge to try to get things done before the end of the year, but again, Mr. Prokop should not have his due process rights infringed because of that.
And you said that earlier as well, but wouldn't it be true, and as Ms. DeBeer points out, if we look at the entire record, and in fact there was no confusion and the issues were submitted, would that not necessarily mean due process has not been violated? It means there was not a trial with live witnesses, but that would mean the record would support the finding that there was a meeting of the minds and agreement to do otherwise.
In Your Honor, there's still due process issues, including if you look at the U.S. Supreme Court case, Cleveland Board of Education, notice and an opportunity to respond. Fundamental tenets of due process, neither happened here. What happened was a trial by ambush. There's new issues raised in one side's briefing. Appellant did not have the opportunity to respond to that. I mean, this is as fundamental as it gets. With regard to a trial just by written submission, I mean, there's no rule or statutory authority allowing courts to have a trial based upon written submission. It is different from motion practice. Again, the rules of civil procedure specifically provide all trials shall be held in an open courtroom. That did not happen here. Yes.
Can you explain to me how your client was prejudiced by not having a trial in open court?
Yes. He was prejudiced because he did not have the opportunity to testify or offer other evidence related to the taxable nature of his traditional IRA, the use of marital funds during the marriage, the value of his sheet metal number 10 benefit fund. He has a series of different accounts that are kind of exotic accounts that were divided. He has a safe fund that the value of which he would lose if he were to leave his employment. And he also had a non-marital claim relative to savings bonds. So there's a lot of issues that would need to be addressed, including dividing two vehicles, a motorcycle, 8 bank accounts, 2 children's bank accounts, a children's CD, 11 U.S. savings bonds, the children's 25 U.S. savings bonds, 2 Roth IRAs, 2 life insurance policies, appellant's labor union safe plan, his labor union benefit fund, 2 credit cards, a traditional IRA, a defined contribution plan, and 3 pensions. So there's a pretty substantial marital estate that needs to be divided. And it, as you saw, it's very difficult to do on paper. And appellant never waived his right to a trial to address these issues. With regard to the best interest.
He made a submission as Respondent's counsel pointed out in her brief, it's included in the addendum. Is there any reason why that information relating to the property that was included in the equalizer couldn't have been included in that submission? Information relating to the tax implications and the other issues that you're raising here.
In your honor, I mean, the threshold issue is that this is just a process that was never agreed upon as far as the taxable nature. I mean, the IRS tax code is clear that a traditional IRA is a pre-tax asset and subject to taxes. You know, that's as a matter of law under USC code, that's the case. I think it's foolhardy to expect parties to have an expert if they have a retirement account and to submit expert testimony regarding whether a traditional IRA is taxable or not. Again, this is straight from the IRS tax code. With that said, I'm sorry.
Counsel, you can proceed. It looks like you have about 20, 30 seconds remaining on the clock. Go ahead, Mr. Gilbert.
Thank you, Your Honor. If you look at, there's a case Schmidt that we cited in our brief, basically saying the court should not have to mine the record and in doing so, they would make credibility determinations, regarding what's in the best interest of the minor child. Again, the court needs to make detailed factual findings regarding that, which did not happen here. And I'm out of time. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Our thanks to both lawyers today. We very much appreciate hearing from you on these issues. The matter is now submitted to this court for its decision. We will issue a decision within the statutory time.